pointed to the horizon. Above the desert pan, just visible beyond a stand of thorny acacias, loomed a cluster of dark shapes.
"Those are the Tsodilo Hills, a very important place for my people, a sacred place, you would call it. But I have made them too easily visible, too stark."
She stared. Despite his discontent, there was something compelling about the hills, the only tall things in this wide, flat land. If the real ones were even remotely similar, she could understand the power they must hold over the imaginations of Khabu's people. Rini reached up and stroked her earrings again, then touched the eggshell necklaces at her throat.
"How about me? Do I look as much like me as you look like yourself?"
He shook his head.
"That would have been presumptuous. No, my own sim was concocted from an earlier project at the Pali. I added to it for this, but at the moment I have only two other sims, male and female. They are made to look like a man and woman of my people."
His smile was sad and a little bitter.
"In this place, anyway, I shall make sure no one comes onto Bushman land but Bushman."
He led her down a sandy slope, deeper into the pan. Flies hummed lazily. The sun was so fierce that Rini found herself longing for a drink of water, despite the fact that they had surely been in the tanks less than half an hour. She almost wished they had hooked up the hydration system, despite her dislike of needles.
"Here," said Khabu.
He squatted on his heels and began to dig with the butt of his spear.
"Help me. What are we looking for?"
He did not answer, but concentrated on digging. The work was hard, and the heat of the sun made it even more tiring. For a moment, Rini completely forgot that they were in a simulation.
"There!"
Khabu leaned forward. Using his fingers, he unearthed something that looked like a small watermelon from the bottom of the hole. He lifted it triumphantly.
"This is a tsama. These melons keep my people alive in the bush during the season of drought. When the springs have no more water..."
He took his knife and cut the melon's top off, then took the butt of his spear, wiped it clean of dirt, and pushed it into the melon. He worked it like a pestle until the fruit's contents were a liquefied pulp.
"Now you drink it,"
he said, smiling.
"But I can't drink, or at least I can't taste anything."
He nodded.
"But when my simulation is complete, you will have to drink, whether you can taste it or not. No one can live like my people if they do not struggle to find water and food in this harsh land."
Rini took the tsama rind and upended it over her mouth. There was a curious absence of sensation around her face, but she could feel little splatters of wetness down her neck and belly. Khabu took it from her, said something she could not understand, full of clicks and trills, and drank from the melon himself.
"Come," he said. "There are other things I wish to show you."
She stood, troubled.
"This is wonderful, but Jeremiah and my father will be worried about us if we're on too long. I didn't tell him how to monitor our conversation, and I doubt he'd be able to figure it out on his own. They might even try to pull us out."
"Knowing I would show you this place, I told them we might be longer than you had planned."
Khabu looked at her for a moment, then nodded.
"But you are right. I am being selfish."
"No, you're not. This is wonderful."
She meant it. Even if he had cobbled it together from other modules, he had an incredible flair for virtual engineering. She could only pray that his association with her ended happily. After seeing even this small piece, she thought it would be a crime if his dream went unfulfilled.
"It's truly wonderful. I hope to spend a lot more hours here someday soon, Khabu.
Do we have time for something else? It is important to me."
"Of course."
"Then come with me a little way farther."
He led her forward. Although they walked what seemed to be only a few hundred yards, the hills were suddenly much closer, looming overhead like stern parents. In their shadows stood a small circle of grass shelters.
"This is unnatural, to move so fast, but I know our time is short."
Khabu took her wrist and drew her to an empty stretch of sandy soil before one of the shelters. A pile of small sticks was already laid out there.
"I must also do one more unnatural thing,"
he gestured. The sun began to move swiftly. In moments, it had completely disappeared behind the hills, and the sky had darkened to violet.
"Now I will build a fire."
Khabu took two sticks from his pouch.
"Male stick, female stick,"
he said with a smile.
"That is what we say."
He placed one into an indentation in the other, then held the second to the ground with his feet, while he rapidly spun the first between his palms. From time to time he plucked bits of dry grass from his pouch and pushed them into the indentation. Within moments, the grass was smoking. The stars had burst into view in the night sky overhead, and the temperature was dropping rapidly. Leany shivered. She hoped her friend would get the fire going soon, even if that meant stretching accuracy a little. As Khabu transferred the smoldering grass to the pile of sticks, she leaned back, looking at the sky. It was so wide, wider and deeper than it ever seemed over Durban, and the stars seemed so close, she almost felt she could reach up and touch them. The fire was surprisingly small, but she could feel its warmth. However, Khabu did not give her much chance to enjoy it. He took two strings of what appeared to be dried cocoons from his pouch and tied one around each of his ankles. When he shook them, they made a soft, buzzing rattle. "Come," he rose and beckoned. "Now we will dance."
"Dance?
Do you see the moon?" he pointed.
It floated in the blackness like a pearl in a pool of oil.
"And the ring around it, those are the marks that the spirits make when they dance around it, for they feel it to be a fire just like this."
He reached out and took her hand.
Although a part of her could not forget that they were in separate tanks, yards apart, she also felt his familiar presence. However physics might define it, he was definitely holding her hand, leading her into a strange, hopping dance.
"I don't know anything about..."
"It is a healing dance. It is important. We have a journey ahead of us, and we have suffered much pain already. Just do as I do."
She did her best to follow his lead. At first, she found it difficult. But then, when she stopped trying to think about it, she began to feel the rhythm. After a while, she felt nothing but the rhythm. Shake, step, shake, shake, step, head back, arms up. And always there was the quiet whisper of Khabu's rattles and the soft slap of their feet on the sand. They danced on beneath the ringed moon, before the hills that bulked black against the stars. For a while, Rini quite forgot everything else. She pulled off her mask before she was all the way out of the gel, and for a moment found herself choking. Her father's hands were under her arms, and he was pulling her out of the tank.
"No," she said, fighting for breath.
"Not yet." She cleared her throat.
"I have to scrape the rest of this stuff off me and put it back in the tank. It's hard to replace. So there's no point dripping it all over the floor."
"You were down a long time," her father said angrily. "We thought the two of you gone brain dead or something. That man said not to bring you up, that your friends say it's okay."
"I'm sorry, Papa." She looked over to Khabu, who was seated on the edge of his own tank scraping gel. Weenie smiled at him. "It was amazing. You should see what Khabu's made. How long were we under?"
"Almost 2 hours," said Jeremiah disapprovingly.
2 hours? My God!" Weenie was shocked. "We must have spent at least an hour of that dancing. I'm so sorry. You must have been worried to death."
Jeremiah made a disgusted face.
"We could see that your breathing and heart and whatnot were all normal, but we were waiting for you to come back and join us, because that Frenchwoman's been wanting to talk to you. Important message, she said."
"What? What did Martine want? You should have brought us back out."
"We never know what you expect," said her father, scowling. "All this craziness. How's someone supposed to know when he's going to get shouted at? What he's supposed to do?"
"All right, all right. I said I was sorry. What was the message?"
"She say call her when you come out."
Weenie wrapped a military-issue bathrobe around her still-sticky form, then called Martine's exchange number. The mystery woman was on the line within moments.
"I am so glad you have called. Was the experiment a successful one?" "Excellent. But I can tell you about that later. They said you had an urgent message."
"Yes, from Monsieur Singh. He said to tell you that he thinks he may have found a way to beat the other land security. But he also said levels of use have gone up dramatically in the past few days. The network is very busy, which may mean something important is about to happen. Perhaps that was the meaning of the hourglass, the calendar. The 10 days are almost up in any case. We dare not wait for another opportunity."
Rini's heart sped.
"Which means?"
"Which means that Singh will go in tomorrow. What he cannot do by planning, he will trust to luck," he said. "And if you are joining us, you will have to do it then. There may not be another chance."
Chapter 30. In the Emperor's Gardens. Netfeed News.
Malaysian rebels warn West to stay away.
Visual. Jungle fighting in North Borneo. Rocket casualties. VO.
The Malaysian rebel group, which calls itself Swords of New Malacca, warned Western tourists and business travelers that they are entering a war zone. The rebels, who have waged a 6-year war against the Malaysian federal government to overturn Malaysia's secular and pro-Western policies, killed 3 Portuguese diplomats in an attack last week, and say that they will now treat all Westerners in Malaysia, including Australians and New Zealanders, as enemy spies.
Visual, Rong Hussein Kawat, new Malaccan rebel spokesman. Hussein Kawat.
Europe and America have enforced a regime of hooliganism on the rest of the world for 500 years. But their day is ending, in blood, if necessary. Our own blood may flow, but it will no longer be poisoned by Western credits, Western ideas. The corruption of the federal government infidels in Kuala Lumpur is a stink in the nostrils of heaven.
Hurley Brummond stood at the helm of the airboat, wheel clenched in one hand, his stern, bearded profile silhouetted by the light of Ulamar's 2 moons.
"We'll tweak their noses, Jonas,"
he bellowed over the roar of the wind.
"The green-skinned priests will learn they can't go fiddling about with an earthman's fiancée."
Paul wanted to ask a question, but he didn't have the heart to shout. Brummond had returned to his figurehead pose, staring down on the lantern-lit towers of Tuktu Bim. Paul had wanted to find the winged woman again, but he was not entirely sure that this was the way he wanted to go about it.
"Hurley's got his blood up now," said Professor Bagwalter. "It really won't do any good to fret. But never fear. He's mad as a March hare, but if anyone can get the job done, he can."
The airboat abruptly lurched downward, making the ship's brass fittings rattle. Paul put out a hand to steady himself, then reached to make sure Galley had not been knocked over. The boy was wide-eyed, but seemed more excited than frightened. The airboat's angle of descent steepened, with the ship plunging downward at such an angle that it was all Paul could do simply to hold on to the railing. Hurley Brummond left his position at the helm, dragging himself forward hand over hand along the railing, then tugged at a great metal handle on the back of the ship's cabin. All the ship's lanterns, on the bow, on the sailcloth wings, and along the hull, suddenly went dark. The airboat continued to plummet. A tower top suddenly leaped up on one side of the ship and flashed upward past them. Another daggered up just beyond the rail on Paul's side, so close he felt he could touch it. A third sprouted beside the first. Terrified, Paul looked through the carved railing. The ship was hurtling down toward an entire forest of needle-sharp minarets.
"My God!"
Paul jerked Galley toward him, although he knew there was nothing he could do to protect the boy.
"We're going to—"
The ship suddenly bottomed out, throwing Paul and the others to the deck. A moment later it shuddered to a halt in midair, hovering in the midst of a thicket of pointed roofs. Brummond had scrambled back to the helm.
"Sorry about the bump,"
he brayed.
"Had to snuff the lanterns, though. We're going to surprise them."
As Paul helped Galley to his feet, Brummond was tipping a furled rope ladder over the railing. As it rustled down into darkness, he straightened with a satisfied smile on his face.
"Perfect. We're right over the Imperial Gardens, just as I thought. They'll never expect us to go that way. We'll be in and out with your fair lady in the blink of an eye, Jonas, old man."
Professor Bagwalter was still kneeling on the deck, searching for his glasses.
"I say, Hurley, that was a bit uncalled for, wasn't it? I mean, couldn't we have made a bit more leisurely approach?"
Brummond shook his head with obvious fondness.
"Fags, you old stick-in-the-mud, you know my motto. Move like the wind, strike like lightning. We aren't going to give these ghastly priest chappies a chance to spirit our quarry away. Now let's get cracking. Jonas, you'll come, of course. Bags, I know you're anxious for a little action, but perhaps you should stay here with the ship. Be ready to take off. Besides, someone ought to keep an eye on the young lad."
"I want to go."
Galley's eyes were bright.
"No, against my rules."
Brummond shook his head.
"What do you say, Bags? I know it's hard cheese on you, but just this once perhaps you should give the adventure side a miss."
The professor did not seem unduly put out. In fact, Paul thought he seemed grateful for the excuse.
"If you think it best, Hurley."
"That's settled, then. Let me just strap on old Betsy here."
Brummond opened the lid of a trunk beside the steering wheel and removed a sheathed cavalry saber, which he belted around his hips. He turned to Paul.
"How about you, old man? Weapon of choice? I might have put a pistol or two in here, but you'll have to promise not to spark one off until I give the word."
Brummond pulled out a pair of what to Paul seemed vaguely archaic sidearms, and peered down their barrels.
Good. Both loaded.
He passed them over to Paul, who shoved them in his belt.
After all, we don't want to let the priests know we're on our way any earlier than we have to,
Brummond continued to dig in the chest.
So you'll need something to start with, too. Ah, just the ticket.
He straightened up, holding an outlandishly ornate weapon that seemed part axe, part spear, and which stood two-thirds of Paul's height.
Here you go. It's a Vonari Saljak. Surprisingly good for close-in work. And rather appropriate, since your fiancé is one of them. A Vonari, I mean.
As Paul stared at the strange filigreed weapon, Brummond trotted to the railing and swung his leg over.
Come on, old man. Time to go.
Feeling almost helpless, as though he moved through someone else's dream, Paul followed him over the railing.
Be careful, said Galley.
But Paul thought the boy looked like he was enjoying the prospect of violent danger more than he ought to be.
Do try to keep Hurley from creating an interplanetary incident, added Bagwalter.
Paul found it difficult to climb with the Saljak in one hand. 100 feet below the ship, and still half that distance from the ground, Brummond stopped and waited impatiently for him.
I say, old chap, you'd think it was someone else's sweetheart entirely that we were on our way to rescue. We're going to lose the element of surprise.
I'm not really used to this sort of thing. Paul swayed, his free hand sweaty against the ladder's rungs.
Here.
Brummond reached up and took the Saljak from him, then resumed his descent. Paul now found it easier to descend, and could even look around for the first time. They were surrounded still, but by oddly shaped trees rather than towers. The garden seemed to stretch a great distance in all directions. The warm Martian night was full of the scent of growing things. There was something about the thick greenery and the silence that tickled his memory. Plants, he struggled to remember. It seemed somehow important. A forest surrounded by walls. Brummond had stopped again, this time at the bottom of the ladder, a short jump from the ground. Paul slowed. Whatever memory the Imperial Gardens had called to now slid out of reach once more, replaced by a more recent concern. You said that they would never expect us to come in this way, but I saw lots of airships tonight. Why will this surprise them? His companion slid his saber out of its sheath, then vaulted lightly to the ground. Huge, flesh-colored blossoms swayed in a breeze Paul could not feel. Some of the trees had thorns as long as a man's arm, and others bore flowers that looked like wet, hungry mouths. Paul shuddered and jumped down.
Because of the Vormargs, actually,
Brummond said in a confidential whisper. He tossed over the Saljak. Paul had to twist to avoid catching it by the razor-sharp blade.
Most people are scared to death of the things.
He set off at a swift pace. Paul hurried after him.
Vormargs? What are those? Martian beasties. Snake apes, some people call them.
Ugly bastards. Paul had only a half second to absorb this concept before something huge, shaggy, and stinking dropped from a tree into the middle of the path.
Speak of the devil, said Brummond,
and swiped at the thing with his saber. Even as the creature snarled and shied back, Paul had a glimpse of slotted yellow eyes and a wide snout full of curving fangs. Two more shapes dropped from a tree beside them. Paul only just managed to get the Vonari axe up in time to ward off a long, taloned paw lashing toward his face. Even so, the blow loosened his grip on the weapon and nearly knocked him over.
"Don't drive them toward the palace!"
called Brummond. He had engaged two of the beasts simultaneously, and his saber was an almost invisible blur in the moonlight.
"Keep them here in the dark part of the garden!"
If Paul could have managed to drive them anywhere, he would have done so happily. But he was hard-pressed just to stay alive. The hairy thing in front of him seemed to have arms as long as buggy whips. Just blocking them as they slapped at his face and belly consumed every part of his strength and speed. He thought of the pistols, but realized he could not possibly draw one before the thing would be on him with its venom-dripping fangs at his neck. Even Brummond was finding it difficult to talk now. From the corner of his eye, Paul saw something stagger back. For a terrifying moment, he thought it was his companion. But then he heard the other man's quiet chuckle of pleasure as one of the beasts fell and did not rise. Still, the second of the Vormargs seemed quite capable of occupying Brummond until its comrade had finished with Paul. Paul took a step backward and almost stumbled over an exposed tree root. As he regained his balance, his enemy leaped toward him. In desperation, he flung the Saljak in the snake ape's face. The weapon was not balanced for throwing. It turned in midair, striking the creature heavily and knocking it off balance, but doing little damage. During the moment's lull, Paul tugged one of the pistols from his belt, pushed it as close to the Vormarg's face as he could reach, and pulled the trigger. The hammer fell. For a hideously long split second, nothing happened. And then the gun jerked and made a noise like a thunderclap as fire vomited from the end of the barrel. The snake ape sat down. Nothing left atop its shoulders but blood, tatters of burnt flesh, and fur.
"For heaven's sake, old chap, what are you doing?"
Brummond was clearly irritated. He had braced his boot against the chest of the second Vormarg he had killed so he could pull his saber out of its belly.
"I told you not to touch that off until I said to."
Paul was too busy struggling for breath to argue.
"Well, if there are any more of these lovelies around, that'll bring 'em down on us like flies on a honey wagon. Not to mention that you've doubtless woken up the Sumbar's Onyx Guard. We'd better leg it toward the Imperial residence and make the best of a bad business. I must say, I'm disappointed in you, Jonas."
Brummond wiped his saber on a leaf the size of a tea tray, then sheathed it with one thrust.
"Come along."
He turned and trotted away through the vegetation. Paul picked up the Saljak and stumbled after him. He tucked the pistol he had fired into his belt and pulled out the other one, just to be prepared. It was impossible to guess what ghastly death trap this idiot might lead him into next. Brummond sprinted through the tangle of the Imperial Gardens as though he had been doing it all his life, with Paul pounding along doggedly behind. Within moments, they reached a stone wall that rose dozens of feet, featureless but for a single window more than a man's height above the ground. Brummond vaulted up and caught at the sill, then pulled himself up. He reached down a hand and dragged Paul after him. The room before them was empty but for a group of stone urns stacked in one corner, and was lit only by a candle guttering in an alcove. Brummond dropped down from the window and moved on noiseless feet toward the far door, listened there for a moment, then led them into the brighter, torch-lit hallway outside. The hall was also unoccupied, but sounds coming from one direction, harsh voices and the rattle of armor, suggested it would not be that way for long. Brummond snatched one of the row of torches from its sconce and touched it to the hem of a tapestry that filled the middle reaches of the wall as far in both directions as Paul could see, an endless and incomprehensible record of animal-headed people at work and play. Flames ran along the tapestry's bottom edge and began to climb upward.
"Come on, man!"
Brummond grabbed Paul's arm and dragged him away.
"That's to slow the Onyx Guard down a jot. A quick sprint and we'll be in the temple precinct."
Bits of burning tapestry had already fallen to the floor, where the carpet was beginning to smolder. Other flames were already pawing at the heavy wooden ceiling beams. The hallway was beginning to fill with smoke. Taltors appeared in some of the doorways as Paul followed Hurley Brummond down the long hallway. Most appeared to have been sleeping. It was clearly hard to tell an earthling complexion from the greenish skin of the Ulamari by torchlight. Several of the palace residents shouted excited questions at them, thinking, more rightly than they knew, that these hurrying men might be privy to the nature of the emergency. Not all were so passive. One huge Taltor soldier, whose black livery suggested he must be part of the Onyx Guard Brummond had mentioned, stepped out of a crossing corridor to bar their path. Paul's companion, showing a slightly surprising degree of restraint, merely dealt him a swift uppercut to the jaw. Paul, a few paces behind, was forced to vault over the collapsed guardsman. "This is all like something out of an old film," he thought, "some Arabian Nights melodrama." And for an instant, that thought opened a whole vista of memory in his head, of countless things and names and ideas, as though someone had swung wide the doors of a great library. Then he slipped on the polished floor and nearly went head first onto the stone tiles. By the time he had regained his balance and was hurrying after Brummond again, the mental fog had returned. But he knew now that there was something behind it, that this murkiness was not his natural state. He felt a surge of hope. Brummond skidded to a stop before a tall archway sealed by a heavy door.
"This is it,"
he said. The noises of pursuit and the sounds of confused palace residents had merged into a single rising din behind them.
"Don't believe everything you see in here, and don't lose your head. Also, don't kill anyone. The Sumbar's priesthood has a deuced long memory."
Without waiting for a reply, he slammed his shoulder against the door. It rattled in its sockets, but did not open. Brummond took a step back, then kicked at it. The door shivered and fell inward, the bolt broken off on the inside. A few white-robed Martians who had apparently come to investigate the first assault on the door were standing just beyond the threshold. Brummond bowled them over like tenpins. As Paul followed him through, another, who had been lurking behind the doorway, leapt out. Paul stunned him with the handle of the Saljak.
"Now you're in the spirit of the thing!" Brummond shouted. "Head for the inner sanctum!"
They pelted down another long corridor lined with huge statues of the same beast-headed beings who had decorated the tapestry, then broke through another doorway, this one little more than a ceremonial screen, and were greeted by a blast of hot, foggy air. They were in a large chamber. An ornamental pool shrouded in steam filled the center of the room. Several more priests, these wearing golden beast masks, looked up in startlement at their sudden entrance. Brummond sprinted around the edge of the pool, pausing only to fling one of the masked priests into the water. The splash set the mists eddying, and for a split second, Paul could see clearly to the far side of the room. The winged woman was slumped on a bench, her chin on her chest, her thick, dark hair falling forward so that it almost hid her face. But it was her. Paul knew it, beyond a doubt. Paul felt a thrill of horror to see her so seemingly lifeless. All this lunatic adventure had been to rescue her. But was he too late? He sprinted forward. Two hissing priests rose up before him out of the mist, waving long, thin daggers. He lifted the Saljak horizontally before him and knocked them backward, stepping on one of them as he hurtled past. Brummond was on the other side of the pool, keeping three more robed assailants at bay with his saber. Paul ducked under a priest's dagger stroke, dealt a backhand blow that sent another sprawling to the tiles, then reached the stone bench in a few steps. He reached out his hand and cupped the woman's face, lifting it. Her pale blue skin was warm, her eyes half open. She had been drugged in some way, but she was alive. He was seized by an intense joy, a feeling as foreign as it was powerful. He had found someone who meant something to him, who perhaps knew something of who he was, where he came from.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Jonas! What are you waiting for? Must I keep swapping chops with these green skins all night?"
Paul leaned forward to pick her up, but discovered that her hands were manacled to the bench. Brummond was still holding the trio of priests at the end of his sword, but several others had escaped and were running for the door, doubtless to alert the guard. Paul stretched the woman out on the bench, pulling her arms out straight above her head, aimed carefully, and brought the Saljak down as hard as he could, sending links flying like popcorn. He lifted her, careful not to crush her fine wings, and threw her over his shoulder.
"I've got her!" "Then leg it, man! Leg it!"
Paul staggered a little as he made his way back around the pool. She did not weigh much. In fact, she was surprisingly light, but he was running out of strength, and the Saljak was heavy. After only a moment's consideration, he let it fall, so he could wrap both arms around his precious burden. He and Brummond met on the far side of the pool and plunged through the doorway. They had gone only a few steps, when another priest stepped into their path, this one robed in black. His golden mask was a featureless disk with eye holes. The priest raised his staff, and the air seemed to thicken. A moment later, a huge spider-like beast appeared before them, entirely blocking the corridor. Paul took a step backward in horror.
"Run at it!"
Brummond shouted. Paul looked at him with incomprehending despair.
"I said run at it! It ain't real!"
When Paul still did not move, Brummond shook his head in frustration and lunged forward. The spider thing dropped down on him, appearing to enfold him in its clicking jaws. A moment later, it faded like a shadow blasted by sunlight. Where it had crouched, Brummond stood over the supine form of the black-robed priest, whom he had just stunned with the pommel of his cavalry saber.
"We'll never make it out the way we came in," Brummond shouted. "But I think there's a door to the roof somewhere."
Overwhelmed, but determined to get the Vonari woman to safety, Paul hobbled behind Brummond as the adventurer led them through the twisting side passages of the temple precinct. Brummond plucked a torch from the wall, and within moments they had left the lighted main halls behind. Paul could not help but be impressed by the way Brummond found his way through the dark and confusing maze. The journey lasted only minutes, but seemed much longer. Paul was again caught up in the feeling that he was living through someone else's dream. Only the tangible warmth and weight of the woman on his shoulder kept him anchored in reality. At last, Brummond found the stairwell. Paul was staggering as they made their way out onto the roof to stand, as he had doubted they ever would again, free beneath the twin moons.
"Of course, damn the luck, Bags is waiting over the gardens," Brumman said. "And unless I'm hearing things, the guard is going to be with us any moment."
Paul could also hear the sounds of angry soldiers swarming up the stairwell. Brumman took his torch and flung it up in the air as hard as he could. It arched high and then fell, flame rippling behind it like the tail of a shooting star.
"Just pray old Bags is keeping his eyes open. Now you'd best put her down and help me lean on this door."
Paul gently set the winged woman on the rooftop. She murmured something but did not awake, then added his flagging strength to Brumman's. Already there were people shouting and pushing at the door. Once it was nearly forced open. But Paul and Brumman got their feet under them and slowly shoved it back.
"Hurley!"
The voice came from overhead.
"Is that you, man?"
"Bags!"
shouted Brumman joyfully.
"Good old Bags! Drop us the ladder! We're having a spot of bother down here."
"It's there, in the middle of the roof."
"Now you go and hoist up your lady love quick as you can while I hold the door."
Brumman spoke as calmly as if he were ordering port in the Ares Club.
"Maybe Bags can give you a hand."
Paul hurried back to the Vonari woman and carried her to the ladder, then slowly began to make his way up, rung by painful rung, struggling to keep her swaying weight from overbalancing him.
"I can't hold them much longer,"
Brumman called.
"Bags, cast off!"
"Not without you, Hurley."
"I'm coming, dammit! Just cast off!"
As Paul clung to the ladder, less than 24 feet above the rooftop, he felt the airship begin to rise. The bottom of the ladder lifted free. Brumman gave the door one last kick, then turned and sprinted toward the fast-rising ladder, even as the door burst open and several angry Onyx guardsmen spilled out. The airship had pulled the ladder up so high that Paul felt his heart sink. They had doomed Brumman, who, madman though he might be, had risked his life for Paul's sake. But Hurley Brumman took 2 great bouncing steps and leaped, higher than Paul could have believed possible, and caught the ladder's bottom rung in his hands. Grinning, he dangled at arm's length as the airship swept upward, and the Sumbar's enraged guardsmen grew ever smaller below.
"Well, old fellow,"
he called up to Paul,
"that was an exciting evening, what?"
The mysterious woman lay sleeping on the bed in the captain's cabin. Even folded, her diaphanous wings almost touched the walls.
"Come along, Mr. Jonas."
Professor Bagwalter patted him on the shoulder.
"You could use some tending yourself. You've eaten nothing since you've been with us."
Paul had sat by her for most of the night, reluctant to leave for fear she would wake up in a strange place and be frightened. But whatever drugs the priests had given her were powerful, and it seemed certain now that she would sleep until they reached the expedition camp. He followed Bagwalter to the airship's small kitchen, where the professor made him a meal of cold meat, cheese, and bread. He took it to be polite, although he did not feel hungry. Then wandered up to the helm where Brumman was relating their adventures to Galley for what was doubtless the 3rd or 4th time. Still, it was a tale worth telling more than once, and Paul had to admit to himself that Brumman did not exaggerate his own deeds.
"And how is your lady love?"
Brumman interrupted the battle against the Vormargs to inquire. Upon being assured that she still slept, he was quickly at sword blows again. Paul moved down the deck, wanting quiet. He stood at the rail and moodily pushed the food around on his plate, watching the 2 moons, neither of them quite symmetrical, as they edged slowly across the sky above the speeding ship.
"She's a lovely craft, isn't she?"
asked the professor, joining him at the rail.
"I'm glad we didn't damage her. Brumund may have been the one who borrowed her, but I would have wound up explaining things to the owner. That's the way it always works."
He smiled. "Have you traveled with him a long time?"
"Off and on for many years. He's a good egg, and if you want adventure, well, there's no one like Hurley Brumman."
"I'm sure of that." Paul looked over the railing. The dark line of the great canal meandered back and forth beneath them, glinting here and there with the scattered lamps of settlements, and sometimes, when they passed over one of the larger cities, set a glimmer by an entire jewel box of sparkling lights. End of side 18. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 19. City of Golden Shadow. Other Land, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 587.
"That's Al Grashin down there,"
Bagwalter said as they flew over an immense expanse of dwellings. Even at their great altitude, it was taking a long time to cross.
The center of the Tortuk ivory trade. Brummond and I were kidnapped by bandits there once. Magnificent city. Second only to Tuktu Bim. Well, there's Noalva, too. They may have more people, but I've always found Noalva a little grim.
Paul shook his head in bemused wonderment. People knew so many things.
There were so many things to know.
Yet, despite the moment of recollection in the Sumbar's palace, he knew almost nothing. He was alone. He had no home. He could not remember if he had ever had one. Paul closed his eyes. The stars in their teeming numbers across the black sky had seemed to mock his hopeless solitude. He gripped the railing hard in his frustration, and for a moment felt a temptation simply to tumble himself over the side, to resolve all his confusions in one dark plunge. But the woman, she'll tell me something. Her gaze, her dark, somber gaze, had seemed like a kind of refuge.
"You appear to be troubled, old man," said Dagwalter.
Startled, Paul opened his eyes to find the other man standing beside him. It's only that I wish I could remember."
"Ah!"
The professor was again eyeing him in that disconcertingly shrewd way of his.
"Your head wound. Perhaps when we reach camp you will allow me to examine you. I have had some medical training, and even some experience as an alienist."
"If you think that might help." Paul was not entirely comfortable with the idea, but did not wish to be rude to someone who had given him so much assistance.
"In fact, there were some questions I was hoping to ask you, if you don't mind, that is. You see, I have been, well, I must confess, rather struck by your situation. I hope it does not seem rude, but you do not seem to belong here."
Paul looked up, struck by an obscure but insistent sense of alarm. The professor seemed very intent.
"Belong here? I don't know that I belong anywhere." "That is not what I mean. I express myself badly."
Before Bagwalter could try again, a shining something streaked past their heads, then was followed quickly by three more. The things, which glowed with their own light and seemed almost shapeless, pivoted in mid-air and flew alongside the airship, pacing the vessel at great speed. "What are those?"
"I don't know."
Bagwalter polished his spectacles and replaced them, then squinted at the streaking smears of light, which rolled and tumbled along through the air like dolphins in the wake of a seaship.
"They are no creature or phenomenon I have seen on Mars." "Oh!"
shouted Brummond from the helm.
"We are being taunted by some sort of otherworldly fireflies. Someone fetch me my rifle."
"Oh, dear," sighed Professor Bagwalter. "You can see that science has a difficult time with Hurley around."
The strange glowing objects followed the airship for almost an hour, then vanished as abruptly and inexplicably as they had arrived. By the time they had gone, Bagwalter appeared to have forgotten the questions he wished to ask. Paul was not displeased. Dawn was smoldering along the horizon as the ship at last began to descend. It had been a long time since they had passed the last large settlement, and Paul could see no sign of humanoid life whatever in this barren section of the Red Desert. Galley, who had been sleeping in Paul's lap, woke up and clambered to the rail. The airship banked, running parallel to a long wall of wind-carved hills. It slowed to ease through a pass, then began to sink at an even more deliberate pace. For the first time, Paul could make out details of the landscape. Odd yellow trees with spiky branches and fluffy purplish plants like tall plumes of smoke.
"Look!"
Galley pointed.
"That must be the camp!"
A small circle of tents, perhaps half a dozen altogether, huddled at the bottom of the valley beside a dry gully. Tethered beside them was another airship, even larger than the one on which they flew.
"That's my Temperance!"
Brummond shouted from the helm.
"The finest ship on Ulamar!"
A group of Nimbors digging in the center of the gully looked up at the airship's approach. One of them went running back toward the tents. Brummond brought the airship down beside the Temperance with expert smoothness, halting it just slightly more than a man's height from the ground, then letting it settle as softly as goose down. He vaulted from the captain's deck and over the railing, kicking up a puff of red dust, then dashed off toward the tents. Paul, Bagwalter, and Galley clambered down a little more slowly. The Nimbors had ceased their digging. and now clustered around the new arrivals, tools still in their hands. Their glances were furtive and fleeting. Their mouths sagged open, as though they could not get enough air to breathe. They were obviously curious, but it seemed a curiosity born of boredom rather than any real interest. Paul thought they looked much more bestial than Clu'ru and his fisher people neighbors.
"And here they are!"
Brumman's voice rang from the crimson stones. He had appeared from one of the larger tents, his arm around a tall, handsome woman in a crisp white blouse and long skirt. Even the sun helmet on her head seemed quite formal and stylish.
"This is Joanna, my fiancée, and Bag's daughter, of course. The only really clever thing he's ever done."
"Welcome to our camp."
Joanna smiled at Paul and shook his hand. Her eyes lit on Gally.
"Oh, and this must be the Muppet. But you're not a child at all. You're almost grown. What a pleasure it is to meet you, young master. I think I have some ginger snaps in my bread box, but we should make certain."
Gally positively glowed as she turned back to Paul.
"But first we must see to your fiancée, for I hear she has been terribly treated by the Sumba's priests."
Paul did not bother to argue over the word fiancée. If Joanna was anything like her intended, it would be useless. "Yes, I was hoping Hurley would help me carry her down."
"Of course he will. Meanwhile, I will set out some morning tea on the porch. We call it a porch, but of course it is really only a sort of cloth roof beside the tent to keep off this scorching Martian sun."
She smiled at him again, then took a step forward to kiss Professor Bagwalter on the cheek.
"And I have not even said a word to you, Father dear. How dreadful of me! I trust you haven't done yourself any injuries while you and Hurley have been off gallivanting."
Joanna ran the camp with almost terrifying efficiency. Within a few minutes of their arrival, she had established the Vonari woman in a bed in one of the tents, made sure everyone had water and a place to wash, then introduced Paul and Gally to two other members of the expedition, a Taltor named Zaro, who seemed to be a cartographer, and a fat little human named Crumley, who was the foreman of the Nimbor work gang. She then led Gally off to the kitchen to help her prepare breakfast. His other responsibility removed, Paul returned to the winged woman's side. He sat on the tent floor beside her mattress and marveled afresh at the powerful effect her presence had on him. Her eyes fluttered. He felt an answering flutter inside his chest. A moment later, her lids slowly drew back. She stared at the ceiling for a long moment, expressionless. Then her face registered alarm and she tried to sit up. "You're safe." Paul moved closer and laid his hand on her wrist, marveling at the cool silkiness of her azure flesh. "You've been rescued from the priests." She turned her huge eyes on him, wary as a caged animal.
"You. I saw you on the island."
Her voice struck the same resonant chord as did everything else about her. For a moment, Paul grew dizzy. He knew her. He did. There could be no other explanation. "Yes," he said when he could find the breath. He found it hard to speak. "Yes, I saw you there. I know you, but something has happened to my memory. Who are you? Do you know me?" She stared at him for a long time without speaking.
"I cannot say. Something about you."
She shook her head, and for the first time the wariness faded, replaced by something more uncertain.
"I am Vala of 12 Rivers House, but how could I have seen you before that moment on the island? Have you been to Vonar, my home? For I never left that place until I was chosen to be the Sumbar's gift."
"I don't know. Damn it, I don't know anything." Paul slapped at his knee in frustration. The sudden sound caused Vala to flinch. Her wings spread, rustling as they brushed against the tent walls. "All I know is my name, Paul Jonas. I don't know where I've been or where I come from. I hoped you could tell me." She fixed him with her black eyes.
"Paul Jonas. The name is strange to my ears, but I feel something when I hear you speak it."
She furled her wings and slid back down into the bed.
"But it hurts my head to think. I am tired."
"Sleep, then." He reached out and took her cool hand in his. She did not resist. "I'll stay with you. You're safe now, in any case." She shook her head slowly like a tired child.
"No, I am not, but I cannot tell you why that is."
She yawned.
"How full of odd ideas we both are, Paul Jonas."
The dark eyes closed.
"Could it be?"
she said, her speech beginning to stumble.
I think I remember a place with many leaves, with trees and plants, but it is like an old dream.
Paul could see it too. His pulse quickened. Yes?
That is all. I do not know what it means. Perhaps it is a place I saw when I was a child. Perhaps we knew each other when we were children.
Her breathing grew slower. Within moments, she was asleep again. Paul did not let go of her hand until Joanna came and dragged him to breakfast. He was on his way back to Vala's side. A mug of tea and a plate of buttered scones clutched precariously in his hands when he was intercepted by Professor Bagwalter.
Ah, there you are. I was hoping to catch you alone. Didn't seem like breakfast-table conversation, if you know what I mean.
What's that? Bagwalter removed and nervously polished his spectacles.
I've been wanting to ask you a question. Well, I suppose it could be considered rather rude.
Paul was very conscious of the hot Martian sun. Drops of sweat trickled down the back of his neck.
Go on, he said at last. I was wondering...
Bagwalter was obviously uncomfortable.
Oh, dash it. There's no polite way to say it. Are you a citizen?
Paul was taken by surprise. He did not know what he had been fearing. But it was not this. I don't know what you mean.
A citizen? Are you a citizen or a puppet?
Bagwalter's voice was a harsh whisper, as though he were being forced to repeat an overheard obscenity. I don't know what I am. I don't know what those words mean.
Citizen?
Of where? The professor stared at him intently, then took out his pocket handkerchief and wiped his brow.
Perhaps it is not required to tell here. I must confess that I have never asked anyone before. Or perhaps my English is not as good as I believed it was, and I have not made myself understood.
He looked around. The Taltor Zaro was walking toward them, but was still far away.
I am privileged to be a guest of Mr. Jun Bao, a very important person, the most powerful man in the New China Enterprise. Perhaps you have heard of him. He is a close friend and associate of Mr. Jongleur, whose creation this is, and so I have been permitted to come here.
Paul shook his head. It was all gibberish, or almost all. The last name had a faint resonance, like an arcane word from a nursery rhyme unheard since childhood. The professor, who had been watching him carefully, clucked his tongue in sad resignation.
By thought, because you did not seem to fit here. I meant no offense, but there are so few other citizens. One or two I have met in the Ares Club, but they are mostly out having adventures. Also, I feared that secretly they were laughing at my English. It is not surprising, perhaps. I was quite fluent once, but I have not used it since my university days at Norwich. In any case, I hoped to have someone real to talk to. I have been in this simulation for a month, and it is sometimes lonely.
Paul took a step backward, baffled and more than a little frightened. The professor was spouting incomprehensibilities, but some of them seemed as though they should mean something to him.
Professor!
The cartographer had almost reached them. His jade-tinged skin was shiny with perspiration. He did not look as well suited to the climate as the Nimbor laborers.
Gracious sir, forgive my interruption, but you are wanted for a conversation on the radiophonic device.
Bagwalter turned, his impatience obvious.
For God's sake, what is it? Who would be calling?
It is the Telari Embassy in Taktubim.
The professor turned back to Paul.
I'd better take care of this. Listen, old man, if I've said something offensive, it was unintentional. Please put the whole thing out of your mind.
He tried to hold Paul's gaze as if searching for something, his expression almost yearning. For a moment, Paul thought he could sense a very different face looking out from behind the mask of the phlegmatic Englishman. Troubled, Paul watched Bagwalter head back toward the main circle of tents. Vala was awake and sitting up in bed when he arrived, her wings partially unfurled. There was something both confusing and gloriously appropriate about the great feathered sweeps that extended on either side of her, but Paul was already full-fed with half-memories. As he told her the complete story of her rescue from the Sumbar's palace, he gave her the tea, which was finally cool enough to drink. She took it in both hands and lifted it to her mouth for a tentative sip.
It's good.
She smiled. Her look of pleasure made his insides ache.
Strange, but I like it. Is it an Ulamari drink?
I think so. He sat down on the tent floor, his back against the stiff canvas. There are a lot of things I don't remember, of course. So much that I don't know where to start thinking sometimes. She gave him a long, serious look.
You should not have taken me from the priests, you know. They will be angry. In any case, they will only choose another daughter of Vonar for the sacrifice.
I don't care. That may sound terrible, but it's true. I have nothing but you, Vala. Can you understand that? You are my only hope of finding out who I am, where I come from.
But how can that be?
Her wings lifted and extended, then folded behind her once more.
Before I came here for festival season, I never left my world, and in all my life I have only met a few of you, Tel'ari. I would remember you, surely.
But you said you remembered something. A leafy place, trees, a garden, something like that. And you said my name sounded familiar. She shrugged her slender shoulders.
It is strange, I admit.
Paul was becoming increasingly conscious of an odd grinding sound coming from outside, but he was unwilling to be distracted. It's more than strange, and if I know anything in the world, it is that you and I have met before. He moved closer and took her hand in his. She resisted for only a moment, then allowed him to possess it. He felt as though he could draw strength from the mere contact. Listen, Professor Bagwalter, he's one of the people who helped rescue you. He asked me some very strange questions. I felt they should mean something to me, but they didn't. He called this place a simulation, for one thing.
A simulation? Did he mean an illusion, like the trickery practiced by the Sumbar's priests?
I don't know. And he mentioned names, lots of names. Shongluer was one of them. The other was something like June Bao. There was a rustle at the tent door. Paul turned to see Galli pulling the flap aside. The harsh whining noise was markedly louder.
Paul, come see! They're almost here, and it's the most wonderful machine!
Paul was irritated, but it was hard to ignore the boy's excitement. He turned back to find that Vala had pushed herself against the tent wall, her black eyes wide. What is it?
That name.
She lifted her long-fingered hands as though to keep something away.
I do not like it.
Which name?
Paul, come on!
Galli was pulling at his arm. The grinding was very loud now, and there was a deeper noise beneath it that he could feel through the very sand beneath the tent floor. It was almost impossible to ignore.
I'll be back in a moment, he told Vala,
then allowed Galli to lead him out the door of the tent, where he stopped in astonishment. Waddling down the valley toward the camp was the strangest machine he had ever seen, or could ever imagine seeing, a huge four-legged device almost 100 feet long, that looked like nothing so much as a mechanical crocodile made of metal beams and polished wooden panels. The head was as narrow as the prow of a ship. The back, except for 3 giant smokestacks belching steam, was covered with striped tenting. Flywheels turned, pistons plunged up and down, and steam whistled from the vents as the thing slowly made its way down the slope. Paul could just dimly see several tiny figures standing in a recessed space on the top of the head.
"Isn't it grand?"
shouted Galli over the racket. Professor Bagwalter appeared around the corner of one of the tents and approached them.
"Frightfully sorry about all this," he bellowed. "They just called on the radio phone. Apparently they're from the Tel'ari Embassy, supposed to perform some kind of check on our arrangements before we leave for the back of beyond. Some little irritation devised by the Sumbar's mandarins, I have no doubt. Our embassy wallahs are always trying to stay on the Sumbar's good side, which usually means bad luck for the rest of us.
Do you think it has anything to do with rescuing Vala?
Paul shouted, watching in helpless fascination as the monstrous vehicle crawled to a halt a few dozen yards outside the camp, shuddering and piping like a tea kettle as its boilers were vented. A golden sun was painted on its side, surrounded by 4 rings, the inner 2 and outermost white, the 3rd bright green.
Oh, I rather doubt that, old man. You saw how slow the thing is. They would have had to set out a couple of days ago.
As the clamor of the device died down, Paul heard Vala's wings rustling behind him. He blindly reached out a hand. A moment later, he felt her fingers close around his.
What is it?
Someone from the embassy, but it might be a good idea if they didn't see you, he said. The great mechanical head had settled to within only a few feet of the ground. Now the side of it opened up, tumbling outward in an array of hinged plates that formed a stairway. A pair of figures moved out of the shade of the awning toward the steps.
"I suppose I'd better make myself useful," said Bagwalter,
starting toward the strange crocodile machine. Something about the men moving down the stairway struck Paul with a pang of unease. The first was thin and angular. Something glinted on his face as though he wore spectacles like the professor's. The second, only now emerging from shadow, was so grotesquely fat that he seemed to be having a difficult time descending. Paul stared, his fear growing. There was something dreadful about this pair, something that radiated chill through his thoughts. Vala was moaning in his ear. As he turned toward her, she jerked her hand away and took a stumbling step back. Her eyes were so wide with horror that he could see white all the way around her dark pupils.
No!
She shivered as though with a fever.
No! I will not let those two have me again!
Paul grabbed at her, but she had already moved out of reach. He darted a glance back at the new arrivals, who were just reaching the bottom of the stairs. Hurley Brummond and Joanna were stepping forward to welcome them, and the professor was only a few yards behind.
Come back! He called to Vala. I'll help you!
She spread her wings, then took a few steps away from the tents and brought the great pinions down. They beat the air with an audible crack. They flapped again and again, and her feet began to lift from the red sand.
Vala!
He sprinted after her, but she was already 6 feet off the ground and rising. Her wings spread wider, catching the thin desert breeze, and she vaulted higher still.
Vala!
He jumped, reaching hopelessly, but she was already as small and far away as the notion came to him without source or explanation, an angel atop a Christmas tree.
Paul, where is she going?
Galley seemed to think it was some kind of game. Vala was moving rapidly toward the hills, flying strongly now. As Paul watched her growing more distant, he could almost feel his heart turning to stone inside him. Below, the fat shape and the thin shape were in some kind of heated conversation with the professor. They radiated a terrible wrongness. Even a quick glance at them now filled him with the terror that must have forced Vala into flight. He turned and dashed down the slope toward the far side of the camp.
Paul?
Galley's voice was growing faint behind him. He hesitated, then turned and ran back toward the boy.
Come on!
He shouted. Every moment wasted seemed an eternity. His past, his entire history, was disappearing rapidly toward the hills. And something dreadful was waiting for him at the bottom of the valley. Galley stared, confused. Paul waved his arms frantically. As the boy finally began to trot toward him, Paul turned and bolted toward the anchored airships. He had already scrambled onto the nearest ship, the one that had brought them, when Galley caught up. He leaned down and pulled the boy aboard, then raced toward the helm.
What are you doing? Where did the lady go?
Bagwalter and the others had finally noticed that something was amiss. Joanna, shielding her eyes with her other hand, was pointing at Vala, now little more than a pale spot in the blue sky. But Hurley Brummond was pelting toward the airship at a great pace. Paul forced himself to examine the mahogany panel that contained the controls. There were a number of small brass levers. Paul flipped one. Deep inside the hull, a bell rang. Paul cursed and flipped the rest. Something began to throb beneath his feet.
"Damn it, man! What do you think you're doing?"
Brummond shouted. He was only a few dozen yards away now, covering ground swiftly with his great tigerish strides. His look of irritated disbelief was hardening into fury, and he was already fumbling for the saber at his belt. Paul pulled back on the wheel. The airship shuddered, then began to rise. Brummond reached the spot where it had been and jumped, but fell short and tumbled back to the ground in a cloud of dust. The two new arrivals were hurrying forward, arms waving.
"Don't be a fool, Jonas!"
Professor Bagwalter shouted, his hands cupped around his mouth.
"There's no need to—"
His voice became too faint to hear as the airship rapidly gained altitude. Paul turned his eyes upward. Vala was only a pinpoint on the horizon, already traveling above the sawtoothed hills. The camp quickly fell away behind them. The ship rocked and pitched as Paul struggled to decipher the controls, then abruptly rolled sideways. Galley slid down the polished floor of the cockpit, only saving himself by a last-moment clutch at Paul's leg. Paul wrestled the ship back more or less level, but it was not stable, and they were receiving rough handling in the windier skies above the hills. Vala was a little closer now. Paul felt a moment's sense of satisfaction. They would catch her, and the three of them would flee together. Together, they would solve all the riddles.
Vala!
He called, but she was still too distant to hear him. As they came across the crest of the hills, a sudden gust of wind pushed them sideways once more. Despite Paul's straining hands on the wheel, the ship's nose dipped down. Another gust set them spinning, and he lost control. Galley clung to his leg, shouting in terror. Paul pulled back on the wheel until his joints were aflame with agony, but the ship kept tumbling. First the ground leaped up at them, then they were falling into the sky, then the ground was springing at them once more. Paul had a brief, cracked glimpse of the great canal writhing below them like a dark serpent. Then something smacked against his head, and the world exploded into sparks. Chapter 31 Bleak Spaces Netfeed Music Dangerous Sonics Band Visual Young Woman in Pressurized Hospital Tent V.O. After a series of injuries and one death during the latest tour by the power wig band Will You Still Love Me When My Head Comes Off, promoters have banned the use of sound equipment that operates outside the range of human hearing. The ban was prompted when American and European insurance companies declared they would no longer insure events where dangerous sonics are used. Visual clip from Your Blazing Face is My Burning Heart. WYSTLM, WMHCO, and other power wig groups have in turn threatened to boycott the U.S. and Europe if necessary, saying they cannot allow bureaucrats to interfere with their artistic expression. Rini hated it when her father sulked, but this was one time she had no intention of indulging him.
Papa, I have to do this. It's for Stephen. Isn't that important to you?
Long Joseph rubbed his face with knob-knuckled hands.
Of course it's important, girl. Don't you be telling me I don't care about my boy. But I think all this computer monkey shines is foolishness. You going to make your brother better with some kind of game?
It's not a game. I wish it was.
She examined her father's face. There was something different about him, but she couldn't quite decide what.
Are you worried about me at all?
He snorted.
What? Worried that you going to drown in some bathtub full of jelly? Already told you what I think of that.
Papa, I might be online for days, maybe a week. You could make things a little easier.
Her patience was beginning to sift away. Why did she even try to talk to him? What did it ever bring her except aggravation and heartache?
Worried about you?
Her father scowled, then looked down.
I worry about you all the time. I worry about you since you were a little baby. I break my back to give you a home, put food in your mouth. When you get sick, I pay for the doctor. Your mama and me, we sat up nights praying for you when you had that bad fever.
She suddenly realized what was different. His eyes were clear, his words unslurred. The departing troops that had occupied this underground site had taken everything portable that was of value, which had included any stocks of alcohol. Her father had made the beer he'd bought on the way in last as long as he could, but he had finished it the day before yesterday. No wonder he was in a foul mood.
I know you worked hard, Papa. Well, now it's my turn to do what I can for Stephen. So please don't make it any more difficult than it needs to be.
He finally turned back toward her, his eyes red-rimmed, his mouth curved in a petulant frown.
I'll be fine. Nothing for a man to do around here anyway. And you... Don't you get yourself killed in that thing, girl. Don't let it fry your brain or some foolishness like that. And don't blame me if it do.
And that, Rini supposed, was the closest he was going to come to telling her he loved her.
I'll try not to get my brain fried up, Papa. God knows I'll try. I wish one of us had some medical training.
She was examining with some distaste the IV cannula secured to her arm under a thin sheath of permeable latex membrane.
I'm not very happy about having to do this out of a manual, and a military manual at that.
Jeremiah shrugged as he fitted the same device onto Khabu's thin arm.
It's not so difficult. My mother was in a car accident and had a wound that needed to be drained. I did all that.
We will be well, Rini, said Khabu. You have done a good job preparing everything.
I hope so, but it seems like something always gets missed.
She carefully lowered herself into the gel. Once covered, she removed her undergarments and tossed them out over the side. She doubted that Jeremiah cared one way or the other. and her father was off poking around in the kitchen supplies, unwilling to watch the sealing of the sarcophagi. But she still felt uncomfortable being naked in the presence of her friends. Khabu, who had no such inhibitions, had removed his clothes long ago, and sat through Jeremiah's last-minute instructions in unperturbed nakedness. Rini connected the IV tube to the shunt in her arm, then fixed the urinary catheter and solid waste hoses in place, repressing a shudder at their unpleasant, intrusive touch against her flesh. This was no time to be squeamish. She had to think of herself as a soldier going behind enemy lines. The mission was the most important thing. All other considerations must be secondary. She went over her mental checklist for the dozenth time, but there was nothing left undone. All the monitoring and adjustment would be done by the V-tank itself, through the plasmodal gel. She fitted the mask and signaled to Jeremiah to turn on the air. When she felt the slightly clammy rush of oxygen in the mouth bubble, she slid down below the surface. She floated in dark weightlessness, waiting for Jeremiah to put the system online. It seemed to take forever. She wondered if there could be a problem with Khabu's rig. Perhaps his machinery was faulty, and she would have to go by herself. The thought, and the depth of her own unhappiness in reaction, frightened her. She had come to depend on the small man, on his calm presence and good sense, more than she really liked to depend on anyone. But that did not change the fact of her dependency.
Rini?
It was Jeremiah, talking to her through the earplugs.
Is everything okay?
I'm fine. What are we waiting for?
Nothing. You're ready to go.
For a long, silent moment, she thought he'd gone offline.
And good luck. Find out who did that to the doctor.
We'll do our best. Online gray suddenly surrounded her, a sea of staticky nothingness with no surface or bed. Khabu, can you hear me?
I am here. We have no bodies, Rini.
Not yet. We need to make contact with Singh first. She summoned up the military base's operating system, a typically unimaginative control panel full of view windows, simulated buttons, and switches. Then keyed the pre-programmed connection Martine had sent them. The control panel blinked various waiting messages. Then the panel and the surrounding gray disappeared, swallowed by blackness. After a few moments, she heard the Frenchwoman's familiar voice.
Rini?
Yes, it's me.
Khabu?
I am here too.
All present, Martine. Why are there no visuals?
Singh's voice rasped in her earplugs.
Because I don't have the time or inclination to entertain you with pretty pictures. We'll have more visuals than we can stand if we can get into this system.
Nevertheless, said Martine, you will need to set some default standards for your simulated forms. Monsieur Singh says that many of the nodes on this network will automatically assign sims upon entry, but some will not. Some of those that do will be influenced by the user's own selections, so you should choose something comfortable.
And not too goddamn conspicuous, added Singh.
How can we do that? Whose system are we on, anyway? Martine did not answer, but a small holograph cube appeared from the darkness in front of her. Rini found that using standard VR manipulations, she could build an image inside it.
Hurry up, growled Singh. I've got a window coming up in about 15 minutes, and I don't want to miss it.
Rini pondered. If this Otherland network was actually a huge VR playground for the rich and powerful, as Singh seemed to believe, then a sim that was too generic, too low rent, would attract the wrong kind of attention. She would indulge herself for once and have something nice. She wondered whether it would be best to costume herself as a man. After all, the alpha males of the human world hadn't changed much in the last 2,000 years, and from what she knew, very few of them seemed to think very highly of women. But on the other hand, perhaps that in itself was a reason not to pretend to be something other than what she was. If your average crazed want-to-rule-the-world multi-zillionaire tended not to think of a woman as an object of respect, especially a young African woman, perhaps there was no better way of being underestimated than to be herself.
I had a dream last night.
Khabu's disembodied voice startled her.
A very strange dream about Grandfather Mantis and the All-Devourer.
Sorry? She chose the basic human female armature, which appeared in the cube, impersonal as a wire sculpture.
It comes from a story I learned as a young man, a very important story of my people.
Rini could feel herself frowning as she tried to concentrate on the image of the sim. She gave it her own dark skin and close-cropped hair, then stretched it until it more closely resembled her small-breasted, long-limbed frame.
Do you think you could tell me later, Khabu?
I'm trying to make a sim for myself. Don't you have to do the same?
That is why the dream seemed important. Grandfather Mantis spoke to me in the dream. To me, Rini. He said, it is time for all the first people to join together. But I apologize. I am making it difficult for you. I will leave you alone.
I am trying to concentrate, Habu. Tell me later, please.
She magnified the face and quickly ran through a number of shapes until she found one close to her own. Noses, eyes, and mouths paraded past like claimants to Cinderella's glass slipper, and were rejected in turn until she found a combination enough like her own face not to feel like an imposture. Rini hated people who made their sims impossibly more attractive than the real-life owners. It seemed like a weakness, an unwillingness to live with what you had been given. She stared at the finished product, scanning the placid face. The sight of what could pass under swift scrutiny for her own corpse gave her pause. There was no sense making it too much of a self-portrait. The people whose system they were entering illegally were not the forgiving kind, as she already knew. Why make retaliation any easier? Rini exaggerated the shape of the cheekbones and chin, and chose a longer, narrower nose. She gave the eyes an upward slant. This, she reflected, was not that different from a game of dress-up dolls. The finished product now looked only a little like her, and much more resembled some desert princess from a Sand and Scimitars Netflix. She smirked at her work and herself. Now who was guilty of glamorizing a sim? She outfitted her new body in the most sensible clothing she could think of, a kind of pilot's jumpsuit and boots. If the simulation was good enough, then suitability of outfit would be a factor. She then ran down a row of options for strength, endurance, and other physical traits, which in most sim worlds was a zero-sum game in which every increase in fitness in one category had to be counterbalanced by decreases elsewhere. When she had jiggled the numbers until she felt satisfied, she locked in the choices. The simulation and its prisoning cube disappeared, leaving her in blackness once more. Sing's strident voice cut through the emptiness.
Now I'm going to say this once and once only. We're going in, but don't be surprised at anything. And that includes failure. This is the weirdest damn operating system I've ever run into. So I'm not making any promises. And don't ask me any stupid questions while I'm working.
I thought you were one of the people who worked on it, Rini said. She was getting tired of Sing's bad temper.
I didn't work on the OS itself, he said. I worked on the snap-on components. The operating system was the biggest secret since the Manhattan Project. That was the first atomic bomb back in the 20th century, for those of you who don't know your history.
Please, go ahead, Monsieur Sing, said Martine. We know time is short.
Damn right. Anyway, I've been running little forays on this system and observing it for a long time, and I still have questions. The thing has cycles, for one thing, and I'm not talking about usage. Usage stays pretty constant overall across all time zones, although in general it's been picking up a great deal lately. But the operating system itself has some kind of internal cycle that I can't figure out. Sometimes it works much faster than other times. Overall, it seems to be on some kind of 25-hour cycle. So it'll go about 19 hours at high efficiency. Then things kind of get gluey for about 6 hours or so, and it's easier to get around some of the more obvious security precautions. Mind you, it's still twice as fast as anything else I've ever come into contact with. Maybe more.
25-hour cycles?
Martine sounded shaken.
You are certain?
Of course I'm certain, Sing snapped. Who's been monitoring this thing for almost a year, you or me? Now the only way to get through, and to get you people inside as well, is for me to establish a beachhead. That means I have to get the system to open up and let me all the way in. Then I have to get a fix so I can get us all off fiber lines and onto a randomizing reset. And you're not going to have any pictures until you're in. I don't have time for any of that kiddie crap. So you're going to have to listen to my voice and do what I tell you. Got it?
Rini and Habu assented.
Good. Sit tight and shut up. First, I have to get to the back door me and Melani and Sakata put in. Normally, that would be enough to get into any system. But they've done some crazy stuff to this one. Levels of complexity I've never seen.
Then Sing was gone, and there was only silence. Rini waited as patiently as she could, but without the sound of other voices, it was impossible to measure time. It could have been 10 minutes or an hour when the old hacker's voice buzzed in her earplugs once more.
I take it back,
He sounded breathless and far less composed than usual.
Complexity isn't the word. Insanity, maybe. Everything on the inner rings of this system has got some kind of weird random angle. I knew they were going to install a neural network at the center of this thing, but even those have rules. They learn, and eventually they do the right thing every time, which after a point means more or less the same thing every time.
It was hard to sit in the darkness and do nothing. For the first time she could remember, Rini yearned to be able to touch something, anything. Telepresence, they had called it in her ancient VR textbooks. Contact over a distance.
I don't understand, she said. What's happening?
Singh was so discomfited that he didn't seem to resent the interruption.
It's open. Wide open. I popped in through the back door. Every time I've probed that before, there's been some weird nesting code barrier on the other side. I worked up a solution for that, assuming that was just the first layer of defenses around the heart of the system. But it's not there. There's nothing to keep us out at all.
What?
Martine, too, sounded alarmed.
But does that mean the entire system is undefended? I cannot believe that.
No.
Rini could hear Singh's frustration.
I wish it were. That would just mean a system's breakdown. As far as I can tell, the hole, if you want to call it that, is only in the last ring of defenses. On the other side of my entry point. The back door we built into this particular bit of gear decades ago. But it's never been undefended before.
Forgive me for speaking of something that is unfamiliar to me, said Khabu.
Rini was surprised by the pleasure she felt at hearing his voice through the darkness.
But does it not sound like a trap?
Of course it does!
Singh's bad temper had not stayed away long.
There's probably a dozen of that bastard Atasco's systems engineers sitting in some room right now, like polar bears at an ice hole, waiting to see what pokes its head through. But tell me what else we should do.
Detached from her body as she had never been, floating in a kind of negative space, Rini still felt her skin tingle.
They want us to try to get in?
I don't know, the old hacker said. I told you this operating system is unfathomable. By far the most complicated thing I've ever seen. I couldn't even guess how many trillions of instructions per second. Jesus! These people are really going top of the line. I haven't even heard whispers of processing speeds like that.
There was more than a little admiration in his voice.
But we can't just assume it's a trap. For one thing, that's a bit stupidly obvious, don't you think? They just turn off the security we were expecting to hack through. Maybe it's nothing to do with us at all. Maybe the operating system's doing something critically important somewhere else, and it's diverted some resources from the inner circle of security, figuring it can re-establish them if something gets past the outer circle. If we don't try to go in, we might discover later we'd been counting the white and pearlies of the world's biggest gift horse.
Weenie pondered for only a moment.
This may be our best chance. I say we go in.
Thank you, Ms. Shaka.
Underneath the sarcasm, there was a discernible note of approval.
I am troubled by what you tell us.
Martine sounded more than just troubled. There was unhappiness in her voice that Rini had never heard before.
I wish I had more time to consider.
If the operating system is diverting resources, they could be planning some big change, Singh replied. I told you, there's something going on. Usage is way up, and there seem to have been a lot of alterations. They might even be planning to shut the whole thing down, or cut off outside access completely.
I told Rini that I had a dream, offered Khabu. You may not understand, Mr. Singh, but I have learned to trust such messages.
You had a dream telling you today was the day to break into the network?
No, of course not, but I believe you are correct when you say this opportunity may not come again. I cannot explain why I believe it. But your words speak to me as my dream spoke to me. The time has come for all Grandfather Mantis' children to join together. That is what my dream said.
Ha!
Singh's laugh was brief and harsh.
So that's what? One yes, one not sure, and one I had a dream about a bug? I guess I'm a yes, too. So we give it a try. But don't be surprised if I blow the whole thing up right away. I don't think they can backtrace me. But I'm not even going to give those bastards the satisfaction of trying if I can help it.
With that, he was gone. The silence descended again. This time, the waiting seemed even more unnaturally long. The blackness was everywhere.
Weenie could almost feel it seeping inside her, too. What did she and the others think they were doing? 4 people trying to break into the world's most sophisticated network. Then, what? Sift through unimaginable complexity in search of answers that might not even be there? Finding a particular grain of sand on a beach would be easier. What is he doing? Is he even going to be able to crack it? Martine? Habu? There was no reply. Either through some quirk of Sing's system or some failure of her own, she was temporarily incommunicado. The knowledge only added to her claustrophobic anxiety. How long had she been in the darkness? Hours? Rini tried to bring up some kind of clock, but the system was unresponsive to any of her signals. For a moment, as she moved hands she could not see, to no discernible effect, she felt the beginnings of real panic. She forced herself to lie still again. "Calm down, you silly cow. You're not down a well or buried under a cave-in. You're in a V-tank. Habu and your father and Jeremiah are only a few feet away. You could sit up if you wanted to. Just rip out all those tubes and push open the tank lid. But that would spoil everything. You've been waiting for this chance for a long time. Don't ruin it. Be strong." To occupy herself, and to prove time was really passing, she began to count, bending her fingers in turn as she did so, to remind herself that she had a body, that there was more than blackness and her own voice in her head. She had just passed 300 when something crackled in her earplugs.
"Think I'm through. Some interfering routers will..."
Sing's voice seemed very faint and far away, but even with his words coming in staticky bursts, his fear was unmistakable. "This is Weenie. Can you hear me?" The hacker's voice was even fainter now.
"No reason to. Crazy, but being stalked."
Stalked? Had he said stalked or stopped? Rini fought against her own rising terror. There was nothing to fear, really. Nothing except discovery and reprisal. But at this point, those were beginning to feel like old friends. Only a superstitious idiot could be afraid of the net, she told herself. The serpentine arms of Kali arose from her memory, mocking her. Another burst of static, but no words this time. She suddenly realized that she was very, very cold.
"Habu! Martine! Are you out there?"
Silence. The cold was growing deeper. Psychosomatic, surely. A reaction to the darkness, to the isolation and uncertainty.
"Hang on, girl, hang on. Don't panic. No reason to be afraid. You're doing this for Stephen. You're doing this to help him."
She was shivering. She could feel her teeth bouncing against each other, clicking and rattling her jawbone. Blackness, chill, silence. She began to count again, but could not keep the numbers straight.
"Rini, are you there?"
The sound was thin, as though it came to her down a long tube. The sheer joy at hearing her name spoken told her how frightened she was. A long moment passed before she realized whose voice it was.
"Jeremiah?"
"The tank. Your temperature readings are way down."
His voice was only a little clearer than Sing's had been.
"Do you want..."
A hiss drowned him out.
"I couldn't hear you. Jeremiah, can you reach Habu in the other tank?"
"Such a big drop. Do you want pull out?"
She could tell him she did. It would be easy. With just those words, she would be released from these strange, bleak spaces. But how could she do that? How could she just give up? Out of the void, clearest of all the phantoms flickering in her thoughts, she saw Stephen's face behind the crinkled transparency of the oxygen tent. This, darkness, isolation, nothingness, was his reality every single day. Could she let a few moments of it frighten her away from what might be his only chance?
"Jeremiah, can you hear me? There's interference. Just say yes if you can."
A quietly crackling pause. Then a sibilance.
"Yes."
"Okay, don't pull us out. Don't do anything unless our vital signs go completely wrong. Unless we're in real medical trouble. Do you understand? Don't pull us out."
She heard nothing but crackle.
"Okay."
She thought, "Now you've done it. You've sent him away. No one to step in and save you. Even if... Hysterical girl. You are getting..." She tried to reach a calm center in herself, but was convulsed with shivering again.
"Jesus, mercy, it's cold. What's going on? What's gone wrong?"
Something was growing in the darkness, so faint that she could not be sure that it was not a trick of her reeling mind. A few spots became brighter,
glowing like luminescent fungus in a root cellar. Weenie stared, all of her attention focused, as the spots became lines, then moving smears of white and gray, resolving at last into a living image, blasted inside out like a photographic negative. Sing? The figure hanging in the emptiness before her raised its hands, its jerky movements oddly out of phase. Its mouth worked, but there was no sound in her earplugs except her own shallow breathing. The old man wore the same threadbare robe and pajamas she had seen before. But how could that be? Surely he would have constructed a sim for himself, something that would hide his identity. The cold grew heavy, pushing down on her like a great hand, sending her into spasms of trembling. Sing's image expanded, stretching and distorting until it filled the entirety of her vision, reaching away into infinity at its corners. It opened a twisted mouth the size of a mountain, and the face around it contorted in pain. The sound, which scraped and roared through her earplugs, loud as a jet engine, was only barely identifiable as speech.
It!
And now, even through the killing cold that was making her body shake itself to bits, she could feel something else. A presence that stood behind the bizarre, gigantic apparition of Sing as the endless vacuum of space stood behind the blue sky. She could feel it looming above her, a mind like a fist trembling over a table-crawling gnat, a thing of pure thought that was nevertheless idiot-empty, a presence colder than cold, sick and curious and powerful and completely insane. Her thoughts were flying away like roof tiles in a hurricane.
Hyena!
A part of her shrieked. Khabu's stories and her dreams giving the fear a name. The Burned One. A moment later, as it blanketed her with darkness and the cold burrowed into her guts, something else, Khabu had said, heaved itself up from her memory. All Devourer. It touched her idly then, nosing at her as a beast might nose someone pretending to be dead. An icy void. But something squirming at the heart of it like cancer. She felt certain her heart would stop. Sing's voice again blasted in her ears, a gigantic howl of agony and horror.
Oh, God! It's got me!
His image contorted, twisting itself inside out, and Reenie shrieked in startled terror. A hideously distorted but indisputably real vision of the old man as he must be at this very moment filled the blackness. His turban askew and bathrobe rucked under his arms as he convulsed like a worm at the end of a cruel hook. His eyes rolled back until only white showed. His toothless mouth gaped. Weenie could feel his pain almost as though it were her own, a terrible tension that ran through her like an electrified wire. It flared and then stopped. She felt Sing's heart burst. She felt him die. The image vanished. The dark settled again. The cold clutched her and held her, and the inconceivable something brought her close.
Oh, God, she thought hopelessly. I've been so stupid.
She could feel her brother and her father and so many others crying out their anger at her. The cold grew deeper, impossibly complete, as if every sun in the universe had been extinguished. Her body was now too weak even to shiver. She felt strength whistling out of her, her mind floating, dying. Something abruptly opened before her, a lessening of density dimly perceived. She felt herself falling into it as if from a great height. She was going through something, an opening, a gate. Had she passed through into wherever it had been that she had once wished to enter, eternities ago? Was she being allowed in? Somewhere a memory, teeth, miles of gleaming teeth. A giant mouth, grinning. No, she realized, a last flicker of reason in her dying mind. I'm being swallowed. Chapter 32. The Dance. Netfeed linear.doc. IENHR 23. EUNAM. Death Parade. Visual, slow motion of man being kicked and beaten by mob. VO. Seth Oswald hosts a roundup of deaths, including a lynch mob beating caught on surveillance cameras, a rape murder recorded by the murderer and later used as evidence against him, and a live telecast from a beheading in the Red Sea Free State. Winner of Name the Reaper mascot contest to be announced. So you're having trouble breathing, are you?
The smiling, yellow-haired man pushed something made of cold metal into Orlando's mouth. It clicked against the back of his throat like someone had snapped him there with a weak rubber band. Well, maybe I'd better have a listen, too. He placed a membranous probe against Orlando's chest, then watched the spikes on the wall screen. That doesn't sound good, I'm afraid. Orlando had to hand it to the bastard. He'd never seen Orlando before, but he'd barely reacted at all. Not even that funny look in the eyes Orlando had become used to seeing when people were working hard at treating him normally. The yellow-haired man straightened up and turned to Vivian. It's definitely pneumonia. We'll put him on some of the new contrabiotics, but with his special circumstances, well, I'd recommend you bring him in for a stay at our infirmary. No, Orlando shook his head emphatically. He hated the Crown Heights infirmary, and didn't like this smooth-talking rich people's doctor either. He could also tell that the slick young medicine man wasn't very comfortable with the special circumstances, the unignorable fact of Orlando's long-term condition. But much as he would have liked to, Orlando couldn't really hold that against him. Nobody else was comfortable with it either.
We'll talk about it, Orlando.
His mother's tone unmistakably told him not to embarrass her by being a stubborn little bastard in front of this nice young man.
Thank you, Dr. Dönitz.
The doctor smiled and bobbed his head, then sauntered out of the examining room. Watching him go, Orlando wondered if he'd gone to some special, creepy, suck-up-to-rich-patient school.
If Dr. Dönitz thinks you belong in the infirmary,
Vivian began, but Orlando interrupted.
What are they going to do? It's pneumonia. They're going to give me contrabees just like the other times. What difference does it make where I am? Besides, I hate that place. It looks like they had some horrible person come in and decorate it so the rich jerkies who come here would feel like when they get sick, it's not like normal people getting sick.
A smile tugged at the corner of Vivian's mouth, but she did her best to suppress it.
No one's saying you're supposed to like it, but this is your health we're talking about.
No, it's whether I'm going to die from pneumonia this time or from something else next week or next month.
The brutality of it silenced her. He slid off the examining table and began pulling his shirt on. Even that effort made him feel weak and short of breath. He looked away, determined to hide how miserable he felt. Otherwise, the whole thing would be too much like a bad flick. When he turned, she was crying.
Don't talk like that, Orlando.
He put his arm around her. But at the same time, he was angry. Why should he be comforting her? Who was living under the death sentence anyway?
Just get me the drugs. The nice pharmacy woman will give them to us, and we'll add them onto my pile.
Please, Vivian, let's just go home. They say that making the patient feel comfortable is important.
I won't be any better off in that stupid infirmary.
Vivian wiped her eyes.
We'll talk to your father about it.
Orlando levered himself back into the wheelchair. He did feel pretty impacted, feverish and slow, bubbling a little at every breath. And he knew he didn't have the strength right now even to walk back across the Crown Heights Medical Center to the car, let alone to their house half a mile away across the complex. But he was damned if he was going to get stuck in their damned infirmary. For one thing, they might try to keep him off the net. Nurses and doctors got some idiot ideas sometimes. And now, of all times, he couldn't afford that risk. He'd had pneumonia twice before and survived, although it had never been fun. Still, as Vivian pushed him down the corridor toward the pharmaceutical department, the Patch Ranch, as Orlando called it, he couldn't help wondering whether this might not really be it. Perhaps he had already walked somewhere on his own for the last time. That was a horrible thought. There ought to be some way to tell when you were doing something for the last time so you could appreciate it. An announcement crawling along the bottom of your vision, like when you had the news ticker running on the net. 14-year-old Orlando Gardner of San Mateo, California, has just eaten ice cream for the last time in his life. His last laugh is expected sometime next week.
What are you thinking about, Orlando?
His mother asked. He shook his head. The city stood before him, golden, thrilling, impossibly tall towers shimmering with their own inner light. The only thing he truly wanted waited for him within that thicket of brilliance. He took a step toward it, then another. But the gleaming spires wobbled and disappeared. Cold, wet darkness was suddenly all around him. A reflection. He had lunged at a reflection in the water. And now he was drowning, choking, filling up with black fluids. He sat up, his breath rattling in his lungs. His head felt like a hot balloon.
Boss?
Beazle whirred in the corner, detaching himself from the power outlet. Orlando waved his hand, struggling to get air past the phlegm. He thumped himself on the chest, then coughed. He bent over, feeling the blood rush into his throbbing skull, and spat into the medical wastebasket.
I'm okay,
he wheezed when he got his breath back.
Don't want to talk.
He pawed his T-jack off the bedside table and clicked it into the neurocannula.
Are you sure you're okay? I could wake up your parents.
Don't you dare. I had a dream. Beazle, who had very little in his programming about dreams other than the ability to access literary and scientific references, did not reply to this.
You had a couple of calls. Do you want to hear the messages?
Orlando squinted at the time, superimposed on the upper right of his field of vision and glowing blue against the shadowy drapes beyond. It's almost 4 in the morning. Who called?
Fredericks. Both times.
She's seen. Okay. Return the call. Frederick's broad-faced Sim appeared in the window, yawning broadly, but still somehow looking nervous.
Geez, Gardino, I figured I wasn't going to hear back from you tonight.
Well, what is it? You aren't going to back out on me, are you? Frederick's hesitated. Orlando felt a stony weight in his stomach.
I was just talking to some people at school yesterday, and this guy they know, he got arrested for breaking into some local government system. It was a prank, basically, just tap and nap. But they threw him out of his academy and gave him 3 months in one of those juvenile re-edge holes.
So? Orlando turned down the gain on his voice line so he could cough up more phlegm. He didn't feel up to this. He didn't have the strength to keep pushing ahead by himself. Didn't Frederick see that?
So the government and the big carriers are really cracking down right now. I mean, it's a bad time to be messing around with other people's systems, Orlando. I don't want to... See, my parents would...
Fredericks trailed off, ox-like face showing a sort of blank concern. For a moment, Orlando hated him or her. And when would be a good time?
Let me guess. Never? What is this, Orlando? I asked you before. Why is this city or whatever you saw so damned important? I mean, you signed up to go work for some gearhouse for years, just so you could try to get a little closer to this thing.
Orlando laughed sourly. Indigo Gear had as much chance of getting blood from a billiard ball as years out of him. Then the anger suddenly evaporated, leaving behind only a vacuum-like emptiness. Here, in his dark room, with his parents only yards away and his friend on the other end of the line, he suddenly felt completely and utterly alone.
I can't explain, he said quietly.
Not really. Fredericks stared.
Try.
He took a breath, grunted. When it came down to it, there was no way to explain. Not really. I have dreams. I dream about that city all the time, and in the dreams I know there's something there. Something important that I have to find. He took another pinched breath.
I have to. But why? And even if you do really have to find this place, what's the hurry? We just got thrown out of that treehouse network. Shouldn't we wait for a little while?
I can't wait. After he'd said it, he knew that if Fredericks asked, he would explain everything. The words hung in the air as though he could see them, as though they glowed in the night shadows like the clock numerals.
Can't wait?
Fredericks said it slowly, sensing something. I'm not going to live very long. It was like taking off your clothes in public. Frightening, but then a kind of chilly freedom. I'm dying, basically. The silence stretched so long that if Orlando had not been able to see his friend Sim, he would have thought that Fredericks had clicked off.
Oh, come on. Say something. Orlando, Oh, my God, really?
Really. It's not a big deal. I mean, I've known about it for a long time. I was born with... Well, it's this genetic thing, called progeria. You might have heard about it. Seen a documentary...
Fredericks said nothing.
Orlando had trouble getting his breath. The silence hung, an invisible and painful bond between 2 bedrooms 3,000 miles apart.
Progeria, he said at last. It means you get old when you're still young.
Old? Like how?
Every way you can think of. Lose your hair, muscles shrink up, you get wrinkly and bony, and then you die of a heart attack or pneumonia, or something else that kills old people. Most of us don't make it to 18.
He tried to laugh.
Most of us. Ha! There's only about 2 dozen people who have this in the whole world. I guess I should be proud.
I don't know what to say. Isn't there medicine?
There's not much you can say, Frederico, old buddy. Medicine? Yeah, like there's medicine for growing old, meaning they can slow it down a little bit, which is the only reason I'm still alive. Hardly any progeria cases even used to reach their teens. Orlando swallowed. There it was, all exposed, too late to take back. Well, now you know my dirty little secret.
Do you look...
Yeah, as bad as you'd imagine. Let's not talk about it anymore.
His head was hurting worse than before.
A throb like someone was squeezing it in a hot fist. He suddenly wanted to cry, but he wouldn't let himself, even though the intervening, normal-looking, no-progeria Sim would hide it from Frederick's.
Let's just drop it, okay? Orlando, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, life's tough. I want to be a normal boy. And so do you, at least the online kind. I hope at least one of us gets a magic Christmas wish, Pinocchio.
Don't talk like that, Orlando. You don't sound like yourself.
Look, I'm tired and I don't feel good. I gotta take my medicine now. You know when those little kids are meeting me. If you want to be there, be there.
He broke the connection. Christabel waved her hand. The beam of light leaped up from the official Uncle Jingle's Jungle Crew clock, projecting the numbers on the ceiling. Christabel waved her hand in front of Uncle Jingle's eyes, hurrying before his recorded voice shouted out the time. She only wanted the quiet part of the clock right now. 0013, the numbers read. Still a long time to go. Christabel sighed. It was like waiting for Christmas morning, except scarier. She waved her hand through the beam, and the numbers disappeared, leaving her bedroom dark again. She heard her mother's voice in the living room, saying something about the car. Her father answered, deep and grumbly, so she couldn't understand any of the words. Christabel scrunched down and pulled the blanket up under her chin. Listening to her parents talking when she was in bed usually made her feel safe and warm and cozy, but right now it only made her feel frightened. What if they didn't go to sleep, even when it was 0200? What would she do? Her father said something else she couldn't hear, and her mother replied. Christabel pulled the pillow over her head and tried to remember the words to Prince Pikapik's song in Ottertown. For a moment she didn't know where she was. She had been having a dream that Uncle Jingle was chasing Prince Pikapik because the Otter Prince was supposed to be in school. Uncle Jingle had been smiling his big, crazy smile, getting closer and closer to Pikapik, and Christabel had been running toward him, trying to tell him that Prince Pikapik was an animal, so he didn't have to go to school. But no matter how fast she had run, she didn't get any closer. And Uncle Jingle's smile was so big, and his teeth were so bright. It was very dark, then it wasn't. There was a light flashing on and off. Christabel rolled over in bed. The light was coming from her storybook sunglasses where they lay on the carpet next to her dresser. She watched the lenses blink, then go dark a couple of times, and then she remembered. She sat up in bed with her heart beating really fast. She had fallen asleep. The one thing she hadn't wanted to do. She swiped her hand over the clock, and the numbers sprang onto the ceiling. 0243. Late! Christabel flung back her blankets and scrambled out of bed toward the storybook sunglasses.
"So, you want to know what time it is?"
shouted Uncle Jingle. He was muffled by the blanket that had accidentally fallen in front of his mouth, but his voice still seemed like the loudest thing she had ever heard. Christabel squeaked and pulled the blanket away, then waved her hands in front of his eyes before he could yell out the time. She crouched in the darkness and listened, expecting any moment to hear her parents getting out of bed. Silence. She waited a little longer, just to make certain, then crept across the floor to her blinking glasses. She put them on and saw the words, "Christabel, I need you," sliding past over and over again. She turned the sunglasses on and off, like Mr. Sellers had told her to do last time, but the words, "Christabel, I need you," just kept going past. When she had put on the clothes and shoes she had hidden under the bed, she took her coat from the closet, moving it slowly so the hangers didn't rattle, then opened the bedroom door and tiptoed out into the hallway. Her parents' door was a little bit open, so Christabel went past with the silentest tiptoe she could do. Her father was snoring.
Snick, hurl,
just like Mr. Daddy Whiner. Mommy wasn't making any noise, but Christabel was pretty sure she could see her, a sleeping lump just on the other side of her father. It was funny how different the house looked at night with no lights on. It seemed bigger and much, much scarier, as though it turned into a whole other house after everyone went to bed. What if there were strangers who lived in her house? She suddenly wondered,
the whole family, but they were nighttime people who only came home after Christabel and her mother and father were in bed. That was an awful thought. Something made a noise, a kind of thump. So frightened she felt cold, Christabel held herself very still, like a rabbit she had seen on a nature show when a hawk went by overhead. For a moment, she even thought it might be the nighttime people, that a big man, an angry daddy, but not her daddy, might suddenly jump out of one of the dark corners yelling, "Who's this bad little girl?" But then she heard the noise again, and realized it was just the wind bumping the weather blinds against the windows outside. She took a deep breath and hurried through the wide-open living room. When she got to the kitchen, where the light from the street lamp came in through the windows and made everything seem funny and stretched, she had to stop and think hard to remember the alarm number. Mommy had taught it to her so she could let herself in if there was an emergency. Christabel knew that letting herself out of the house at 0243 in the morning was not the kind of an emergency her mother had meant. In fact, it was just about the worst bad thing that Christabel could imagine doing. But she had promised Mr. Sellers, so she had to. But what if some bad men came while the alarm was off and got her parents and tied them up? It would be her fault. She pressed the numbers in order, then put her hand on the plate. The light above it changed from red to green. Christabel opened the door, then decided to turn the alarm back on again to keep burglars out. She stepped outside into the cold wind. The street was empty in a way it never was in the daytime. The trees were waving their branches like they were angry, and almost none of the houses had any lights on. She stood, hesitating. It was scary, but in a way it was wonderful, too. Wonderful and exciting and big, like the whole base was a toy meant only for her. She carefully buttoned her coat, then ran across the lawn, slipping a little on the wet grass. Christabel ran up her street as fast as she could because she was already late. Her shadow was giant-sized as she went out from under the street lamp. Then it got fainter and fainter until it reappeared again, just as gigantic, but behind her when she reached the next light. She turned on Windicott, then onto Stillwell, her feet going slap, slap, slap on the pavement. A dog barked somewhere, and she bounced down off the sidewalk and into the middle of the street, amazed that she could be there without having to watch out for cars. Everything was different at night. From Stillwell, she turned onto Redland. She was panting now, so she slowed down to a walk as she passed beneath Redland's old tall trees. There were no lights that she could see at Mr. Sellers' house, and for a moment she wondered if she had done something wrong, if she had forgotten something he had told her. Then she remembered the storybook sunglasses spelling out her name over and over, and she was frightened. She started to run again. It was dark on Mr. Sellers' porch, and his plants seemed bigger and thicker and stranger than ever. She knocked, but no one answered. End of side 19. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 20. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams, continuing on page 619. For a minute, she wanted to run home, but the door opened, and Mr. Sellers' scratchy voice came from inside.
"Christabel, I was wondering if you'd be able to get away. Come in."
Mr. Sellers was in his chair, but he had rolled it out of the living room into the hallway, and he was holding out a shaking hand.
"I cannot tell you how grateful I am. Come here. Stand next to the heater for a moment. Oh, and put these on, will you?"
He produced a pair of thin, stretchy gloves and handed them to her. As she struggled to pull them on, he turned his chair back toward the living room.
"No sense in leaving fingerprints. I've cleaned up everything else already. But listen to me babble. Are you freezing, little Christabel? It's a cold night out."
"I fell asleep. I tried not to, but I did."
"That's all right. We have plenty of time before it starts to get light. And we only have a few things left to do."
In the living room, sitting on the little table, was a glass of milk and three cookies on a plate. Mr. Sellers pointed to them, smiling his funny, crooked smile.
"Go ahead. You're going to need your strength. Well, then,"
he said as she nibbled the last bite of the last cookie.
"I think that's everything. Do you understand what you need to do? Really understand?"
Since her mouth was full, she only nodded.
"Now you must do it just the way I said. This is very dangerous, Christabel. And if you were hurt, I couldn't bear it. In fact, if there were any other way to do this, I would never have involved you at all.
But I'm your friend,
she said through the crumbs.
Yes, and that's why. Friends don't take advantage of friendship. But this is really the most important thing, Christabel. If you could only understand how important it is.
He trailed off. For a moment she thought he might be going to fall asleep, but his yellowish eyes popped open again.
Ah, I'd almost forgotten.
He rummaged in a pocket of his bathrobe.
These are for you.
She stared at them, not sure what to say.
But I already have storybook sunglasses. You know that.
But not like these. You must take these home with you when we've finished, and then you must be sure to get rid of the other pair. Throw them somewhere no one will ever find them. Otherwise, your parents will want to know why you have two pairs.
These are different?
They looked just the same, no matter how she turned them. She put them on, but they felt just like her other pair.
You'll see later on. Tomorrow, in fact. Put them on after you get home from school. What time is that? 2 o'clock?
She nodded.
1400 hours is what my daddy says.
Good. Now we need to get to work. But first, would you wash this glass and plate? Just a precaution. I know you have the gloves on, but we don't want to leave any other traces. We don't need to.
When she'd finished and had put the plate and glass back into the cupboard, Christabel found Mr. Sellers in the hallway, sitting so still, with his funny head and small body, he looked like a doll.
Ah, he said, time to go. I'll miss this place, you know. It's a prison, but not an altogether uncongenial one.
She didn't know what the long word meant, so she just stood.
Come along, he said. It's in the backyard.
Christabel had to push away some branches that the wind had knocked down before she could help Mr. Sellers down the ramp. There was just enough light from the street lamp to see by, but it was still very dark. The plants were growing everywhere, even in the middle of the lawn and out of the cracks in the pavement. Christabel thought it looked like nobody had come to do any work in the garden for a long time. The wind was still blowing hard, and the wet grass slapped at her ankles as she pushed him across the lawn. They stopped at the far edge. A rope hung over the grass there, both ends dangling from a funny metal thing on the limb of the big oak tree.
It's here,
he said, pointing at the ground.
Just lift up the grass and push it back. Like this. Now you take the other side.
The grass at the edge of the lawn rolled up, just like her mother rolled up the dining room carpet before she set the floor polisher to work. In the middle of the dirt that was now showing was an old metal plate with two holes in it. Mr. Sellers picked up a metal bar that was lying at the edge of the path and put it in one of the holes, then braced it against the handle of his wheelchair and pried up the plate, which fell over onto the lawn with a soft thump noise.
Now, he said, first me, then the chair. You're about to learn the principle of the pulley, Christabel. I've used it to lower a lot of things already, but it will be much easier with you to help me.
He heaved on the rope to lift his withered body from the chair, then looped part of it under his arms, and with Christabel's help maneuvered himself over the hole. She kept him from bumping against the side as he slowly let the rope slide through his fingers. He only went down a little way before the rope stopped moving.
See? It's not far.
She leaned over the edge. A funny little square flashlight sat on the floor of the cement tunnel, splashing red light on everything. Mr. Sellers sat beside it on the floor, his legs curled under him. If she'd had an umbrella, she could have reached down and poked him. He loosened the rope around his chest and pulled it off without untying the knot.
"We'll hope that I'm the only person who knows about this,"
he said, smiling his melted-looking smile.
These emergency tunnels haven't been used in 50 years. That's before even your mother and father were born. Now the chair,
he said, tossing the loop of rope up to Christabel.
I'll tell you how to tie it."
When she had attached the rope, Mr. Sellers pulled hard. The little metal thing in the tree squeaked, but at first the chair didn't move. Christabel pushed it, but that only made it move sideways. Mr. Sellers pulled again, this time rising up off the floor so that all his weight was hanging on the rope. The tree branch bent, but the chair rose up just a little way off the ground. Christabel steered it over the hole. Then Mr. Sellers let the rope slide back gently through his fingers, and the chair bumped to the bottom of the tunnel. Mr. Sellers pulled himself up into the chair, then attached both ends of the rope to the chair's handles.
"Step back, Christabel," he said.
When she did, he waggled his fingers over the armrest, and the chair started forward. When the rope had pulled tight, the branch bent far down. Mr. Sellers waggled his fingers a little faster. The treads on the bottom of his chair seemed to grab at the tunnel floor, and for the first time the chair made a quiet noise, like a cat purring. Something went snap, the branch sprang up, and the rope flew down into the tunnel.
"Ah, good, the pulley came with it. That was the only thing I was still worrying about."
Mr. Sellers looked up at her. In the reddish light, he seemed like something in the Halloween spook house at the PX.
"I'll be fine from here," he said, smiling.
He folded one of his arms in front of him and bowed his head to her like she was the Otter Queen.
"We who still labor, being weary of the world's empires, bow down to you. That's Yeats again. Now don't forget to put on your new storybook sunglasses after school. And remember, be very careful with the car."
He laughed.
"I'm finally going to get some use out of that thing."
His face went serious again, and he lifted his finger.
"Be very, very careful. Do everything just the way I said. Can you remember the whole rhyme?"
Christabel nodded. She said it all for him.
"Good. Don't forget to wait until the street light goes out."
Mr. Sellers shook his head.
"To think that it has come to this, that I should be forced to such ends. You're my partner in crime, Christabel. I've been planning this for a long time, but I couldn't do it without you. Someday, I hope I can explain to you what an important thing you're doing."
He lifted his crinkly hand.
"Be good. Be careful."
"Aren't you going to be scared down there?"
"No. I may not be going very far, but I'll be free, and that's more than I've been able to say in a long time. Go on now, little Christabel. You have to get home soon anyway."
She waved goodbye. Then, with Mr. Sellers helping from underneath, she dragged the metal plate back over the hole, then rolled back the grass and patted it down.
"Here's the first thing you must think. The bar goes back beneath the sink."
She took the pry bar with her into the house and put it under the sink, just like in the poem Mr. Sellers had taught her. She kept saying the rhyme over and over. There was so much to think about, and she was scared she'd get some of it wrong. The bundle of stiff, smelly cloth was in the can under the sink, just like the old man had told her. She took it and the little plastic thing beside it, then walked out the other kitchen door into the garage. There was just enough light coming in through the window at the top of the door to make out the car, Mr. Sellers' Cadillac sitting in the shadows like a huge animal. She very badly wanted to turn on the light, just as she had wanted to turn on the kitchen light. With Mr. Sellers gone, the house seemed darker and stranger than her own house had been, but the rhyme said not to.
"And leave off every single light."
She made up her mind to be brave, and thought of the next part.
"Now wave to open the big garage door. A switch by the kitchen will do that chore."
When she passed her hand in front of the sensor by the entrance from the kitchen, the garage door slid upward on silent runners. Beyond the shadowy bulk of the car, she could see all the way past the street lamp to the end of Beekman Court. Christabel walked around the car, reciting Mr. Sellers' rhyme. As she passed the passenger door, she saw something inside, slouching in the driver's seat. It startled her so much she almost screamed. Even though she could see right away it was just a big plastic bag. But even if it was only a bag, she didn't like it. She hurried around to the back of the Cadillac.
"Next, find the little secret door, hidden behind the number 4.
The number 4 was on the car's license plate. She pulled at the edge, and the whole license tipped down. Behind it was the place where you put something in the car. It was an old-time car, Mr. Sellers had once explained, and didn't work on electricity or steam. Even though he said the car had been in the garage when he moved to the house, Mr. Sellers always acted like it belonged to him, and he was proud of it. She unscrewed the cap, then unrolled the thick cloth, and pushed one end into the hole and shoved it down. As she was doing this, the street lamp behind her suddenly went out. It got so dark, so fast, that it seemed like all the lights in the world had gone out at the same time. Christabel held her breath. She could see the deep